When we talk about the women of the Bible, we tend to choose and to highlight the ones who are famous to us. Deborah, the brave general. Esther, the fearless queen. Ruth, the faithful daughter. Mary, the mother of our Lord. And of course, Sarah, the beautiful wife of Abraham, the matriarch of the faith. These women occupy a crucial place in the history of God's people. But the Bible is also filled with other women and men, marginal people, covenant outsiders, oppressed, and like Hagar, even slaves. Sometimes, as the famous become models for our piety and for our faith, these other women become models of wrongdoing or of faithlessness. Hagar has often come across as such a model. Headstrong, rebellious. She's an unwelcome intruder into God's plans and purposes that revolve around Abraham and Sarah. She complicates the story of God's covenant of grace. She and her son Ishmael are an unwanted intrusion into God's plans. It's easy to overlook her. But the Bible won't let us. The Bible does not tell the story of covenant history like it's some heroic tale. It's full of strange twists and turns, odd people, dysfunctional families that don't seem to fit. Who is Hagar? Hagar is, of course, a slave in the service of Sarai. She's owned by her mistress. There's no way to perfume that fact, even if it was a prevalent institution in that day and age. Sarai picked her up in Egypt, probably at the time when Abram, remember that story, Abram had, fearing for his life, had passed her off as his sister before Pharaoh, another less than heroic chapter in the saga of Abram. So that's Hagar, a woman, a slave, an Egyptian, an African. How does this story of this Egyptian slave come to figure within the great story of God's promises to Abram and Sarai? The childless Sarai decides that she has to act. Yes, Abram has been given a promise from God that he will make out of him a great nation and that he will make him a blessing, but exactly how this is going to happen, we don't know, and time is running out. So Sarai chooses Hagar to be a surrogate mother for the promised child. Now, to us, this sounds outlandish and immoral, but it was evidently a common practice in that day and time. We have documents from that time spelling out the exact terms of such an arrangement. Later matriarchs, Leah and Rachel, did exactly the same thing. Sarai actually conceived of the idea, if you'll pardon the pun, while Abram conceived the child. Now, Sarai sounds quite pious about it all. She was, after all, trying to make the best out of a tough situation. The Lord, she says, has prevented me from having a child, so go into my slave girl. It may be that I will obtain a child through her. Notice the language. Hagar, the slave, is presented as a convenient uterus under the ownership of Abram and Sarai. Now, it's common to approach these narratives of the Bible as sort of nice moral lessons for us. What's the lesson here, boys and girls? Well, that's clear. Abram and Sarai are jumping ahead of God, you see. They should have waited for the child. They should have had the faith to wait. John Calvin says it's their faith that was faulty here. And look what happens. The whole family gets messed up. If only they had waited patiently, waited in faith, waited on God, followed God's will, everything would turn out okay. That's the typical moral of the story that's been rehearsed over and over in the church. Is that what this story is about? To give us that kind of moral lesson? No. This story is about the ways of God. That sort of moral lesson approach means that you don't really have to pay any attention to people like Hagar. She's a mistake after all. So she's a throwaway character in the interests of moral truth. But if you read the story on its own terms, if you meet it on the ground, so to speak, rather than from our 4,000-year historic perch, it doesn't snap with the same moral crispness. The only recorded promise Abram ever heard up to this point was that there would be a child from his own flesh and blood. Now, we might assume that that would be Sarah's child, but that wasn't said. Up to this point, God had not specifically told him that Sarai would bear a son. That startling promise that Sarai would be the mother comes 10 years later, after Ishmael is born, well after Sarai's prime childbearing years. So looking at things again from ground level, Sarai says, God has made me barren. What is the promise of God that, what is God's promise of a great blessing and a great nation mean to us now? We've got to find another way. Abram and Sarai were stumbling along trying to figure out a way to realize the promise. And God wasn't showing up every day to tell them what to do. He would show up maybe every 15 years or so. They did the best they could. Last week, after my sermon about faith, trusting in God, someone came up to me afterwards and said, in effect, look, living in faith, trusting in God, that's good. But don't we have to use our God-given intelligence also? Don't we have to use our common sense in life? As we struggle with the decisions and actions that we make day by day, God doesn't come along and tell us exactly what to do, does he? God's will is not always so clear to us. We have to decide things, and sometimes when we make decisions, they don't turn out so well. In fact, they look like mistakes in retrospect. Christians are sometimes taught that God has a grand plan for their lives, as though there's this perfectly straight track that leads to God's perfect will. And getting off the track only leads to disaster and to everlasting regret. I don't think that's what the Bible tells us. The Bible has another message. What is most important about our lives is not where we are right now, but what we are becoming by God's grace and Spirit. Yes, we make mistakes. We sin. And we have to live sometimes with the results of our sin and our mistakes. Painful results. Abram and Sarai, like the rest of us, are on a journey that makes lots of twists and turns. But we keep turning back to God, trusting in him, trusting in his promises. I like John Walton's comment. With God, he says, there are no dead ends, only training grounds. We can make all kinds of strange detours and stumble into seemingly bad decisions. But God's purpose through it all is to form in us the character of Christ. Right from the start in this story, you can see it coming. Sarai's neat plan backfired. Hagar, the real human being, appears in the place of Hagar, the slave commodity. As soon as she becomes pregnant by Abram, Hagar, the nobody, suddenly realizes that she is now somebody. No longer a slave, she is going to be the mother of the heir of this family. Her womb, bought for the purpose, worked. With each passing week and month, as her belly blossomed and new life stirred under her heart, it's hard to blame her for that grin of pride and contempt when she glanced at Sarah, barren old Sarah, burning there in the corner in painful jealousy. Hagar had her comeuppance in the world. The trouble was brewing. As it says in Proverbs, one of four things under which the earth trembles is a maid when she succeeds her mistress. Still, Sarai had the power, and she knows how to use it. Appealing to her husband, she demands that he bring justice back to this household, which to Sarai's eyes was falling into anarchy. And Abram understood the realities of the struggle inside of his own tent, and he did his duty. He demoted Hagar, placing her back under Sarai's control. Hagar, who had soared so high, now became an object of Sarai's abuse and scorn. It says, Sarai afflicted her. And there's some irony in this word, because in the Hebrew, it's the same word that's used to describe what happened to the Israelites under slavery and Pharaoh's rule. So, pregnant Hagar runs away. She has some pride too, after all. Instead of letting old Sarai have the fruit of her womb, she's going to keep the child. And she's going to run away into the wilderness. All of this happens on a purely human plane with human decisions. And there are often messed up results. A typical Middle Eastern household struggling with childlessness and the tensions that come when the established order is upset. But then something really wonderful happens. Hagar has made her way some 70 miles all the way back to the border of her homeland, Egypt. And suddenly the absent God appears. Not in the tents of Abram and Sarai, the covenant people. He appears to this runaway slave in the wilderness. We have no indication that Abram, remember Abram who had rounded up a whole army to go after his nephew Lot, lifted a finger to go after Hagar. But it's as though heaven sent out a search party. Listen to these amazing and wonderful words. The angel of the Lord found her. Love that. Why should God care? This wasn't God's plan, was it? Ishmael was not going to be the child of promise. One might think that it's actually quite convenient to give these characters off of the scene anyway. But God does care. God hears the cries of the poor and of the oppressed, even when they're oppressed by his own people. Amazing things happen to Hagar. Hagar is the first person in the Bible to receive a visit from the angel of the Lord. The angel of the Lord, the one who led Israel through the wilderness, the one who appeared to announce the promised child to Mary, indicating, I am Gabriel. Notice something else important. Here, for the first time in the whole story, Hagar is addressed by name. Abram and Sarai merely refer to her as that slave girl. She's addressed by the angel of the Lord as Hagar. Hagar is even the first theologian in the Bible. She personally gives God a name. She knows whom she's dealing with, and she names him poignantly El Roy, the God who sees, or the God who sees me. Hagar, the mistake, the problem, the one we don't need in this story, is the one to whom God pays special attention. Not only that, but God makes an enormous promise to Hagar and her child. His descendants will become a great nation that cannot be counted. And the boy, he says, will be a wild ox of a man. This is not meant mockingly, by the way, but describe a free wilderness sort of guy like the Bedouins. The promise sounds amazingly similar to the promise given to Abram himself. He says, yeah, he's not going to get along with his kin, although interestingly, there's no indication of that at all in the Bible. There's this poignant scene later on in the saga of Abraham Ishmael and Isaac come together to lovingly bury their father, Abraham. As the angel instructs her, Hagar returns to the household of Abram and Sarai, and she bears a strapping boy and names him Ishmael, which means God hears. She can return to the scene of oppression now, for she has a future in God's promise, just like Abram and Sarai. It's not the same future, but it's a good one. We know that in the Bible, the real continuing story is about Abram and Sarai and Isaac and Jacob and all the rest. They are the chosen people. They are the elect family of the promise. They are the ones through whom God will bring his blessing to the whole world. But what about Ishmael? What about Hagar? They have a promise too. They're a part of God's plan. Hagar can be many things to many people. It all depends, in a way, on who's reading the story, doesn't it? In a society where most of the suffering, most of the poverty, most of the abuse falls on women and children, in a place where they are the most vulnerable people of all, this story might be read a little differently. They and we might read of a God who sees their suffering and hears their cries. Maybe it's time for us to stop reading this story only from the perspective of Abraham and Sarah, the owners, the insiders, the covenant people. Maybe it's time to look at the story from the perspective of those people who have walked in Hagar's shoes. The exploited maid, the thin African mother holding her starving, fly-covered child, the alien, illegal alien, the runaway girl, the unwed mother, the single parent, the divorced mother with children, the homeless bag lady. We're surrounded by modern-day Hagars, aren't we? How would they read this story? The God who hears. The God who sees, the God who cares about Hagar too. The story shows us, as I said earlier, the way that God operates in the world. Biblical theologian Walter Brueggemann says that God has not exclusively committed himself to Abraham and Sarah. God is involved with the unchosen as well as with the chosen. Choosing one does not mean rejecting another. And so God bestows a great blessing on Ishmael as well. The scope of his grace becomes wider. As he said to Abraham, "In you will all the families of the earth be blessed." Outsiders, Hagar and Ishmael, are part of that blessing. We can see this played out in the scandal of Jesus' ministry. Remember the Canaanite woman? The outsider who came to Jesus begging him to heal her daughter. Jesus' initial response seems to be cold-hearted rejection. He'd only come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He'd only come for the heirs of Abraham. "You don't take the children's bread," he said, "and give it to the dogs." "Yes," she replied, "but even the dogs get the crumbs that fall under the master's table." Her clever, persistent faith brought out Jesus' smiling response, "Woman, great is your faith." There's an old prayer meant to be prayed just before communion that picks up this theme and remembers that we are all like this Canaanite woman, like Hagar, adopted into Abraham's family, found by God in our own wilderness through Jesus Christ. Will you pray that prayer with me now?